From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the UN Security Council holds an emergency meeting on Ukraine. Anti-Russian activists emerge from the shadows. Is history repeating itself in Egypt?
Here we are again seeing someone from the military who has the support of the military being pretty much the presumptive next president.
Mali reported in a deepening humanitarian crisis. And pilgrims celebrate Palm Sunday in Jerusalem. It's all ahead. I'm Susan Yawkey. The UN Security Council met late Sunday in emergency session at Russia's request, hours before a deadline imposed by Ukraine's interim leadership on pro-Russian protesters who occupy state buildings to disarm or face a full-scale anti-terrorist operation. Sunday, Ukrainian special forces and pro-Russian militia exchanged gunfire in the eastern city of Slovyansk, with both sides reporting casualties. Saturday, pro-Russian gunmen took over the city's police station and government facilities in the largely ethnic Russian cities of Donetsk and Kramatorsk. Russian UN Ambassador Vitaly Churkin, speaking through an interpreter, insisted Ukrainian national radicals are to blame for the current crisis.
We have pointed out on several occasions, including in this chamber, that the terrible actions leading to the coup de force by the self-proclaimed Kiev authorities are threatening once and for all to tear the fragile fabric of the mosaic-based society. The authorities do not want to listen to those who do not accept the imposed dominance in Kiev of national radicals and chauvinist, Russophobian, anti-Semitic forces, seeing in them a threat to their human dignity and to their very lives.
He called on the council to ask Kiev to stop the use of force against eastern Ukrainian people. Ambassador Churkin's Ukrainian counterpart, Yuri Sergeyev, said recent videos posted online clearly show Russian interference in his country.
These videos leave absolutely no doubts that the terrorist groups are not the peaceful protesters, as our Russian colleagues are trying to represent it, but obviously the professional special forces appropriately equipped and armed as such of Russian Federation. Terrorists started using their weapons against Ukrainian law enforcement and military officers. Russia often positions itself as a prominent fighter against international terrorism, but by sending its special agents to Ukraine for diversions and sabotage, it is actually sponsoring terrorism.
U.S. Ambassador Samantha Power accused Moscow of backing the pro-separatist sentiment.
These armed units, some wearing black and orange St. George's ribbons associated with Russian Victory Day celebrations, raised Russian and separatist flags over seized buildings and have called for referendums and union with Russia. We know who is behind this. Indeed, the only entity in the area capable of these coordinated professional military actions is Russia.
She announced that the United States will conclude a $1 billion loan guarantee for Ukraine. Britain's UN diplomat Mark Lyle Grant told the council Russia has massed tens of thousands of troops near the Ukrainian border, in addition to the 25,000 troops it moved into Crimea, which Moscow seized last month.
Russia is seeking to impose its will on the people of Ukraine using misinformation, intimidation and aggression, tactics drawn from the darkest days of the last century. This is completely unacceptable. The Ukrainian people have the right to determine their own future free from Russian interference.
Jonathan Edelman, associate professor at the University of Denver's Corbell School of International Studies, tells VOA's Victor Beatty the Russians hope to replicate their annexation of Crimea and have a tremendous military advantage.
The Russians spend $90 billion a year on their military, and the Ukrainians spend less than $2 billion. The Russians have 700,000 combat troops, and the Ukrainians have 90,000. And NATO has very little. So I think right now they're not intending to invade, but the Russians are using the same tactics that they used in Crimea. And so I think it's something that we need to react strongly and make clear that there really are very serious consequences, because I think they're misreading what happened in Crimea. They had an easy victory in Crimea, and the West talks a lot, but really didn't do very much. And I think the time is for a little more action to make sure the Russians understand more clearly the implications here. They may still be okay if we don't, but I think it'd be very good if we did.
Well, the U.S. U.N. ambassador on television Sunday said the United States is preparing to step up sanctions against Moscow if pro-Russian military actions in eastern Ukraine continue. The next round of sanctions expected to target business sectors such as mining, banking, and energy. But U.S. officials said it was uncertain Europe would go along with penalties that would affect Russia's economy and energy sector. Is this too little, too late?
I'm not sure it's too late, but it's certainly too little. And we need to work with our European allies. We need to recognize that over 30% of all the gas that they import comes from Russia, and that some of the countries led by Germany, which is the strongest country in the EU by far, are very reluctant to go very far with this because of their history in World War II. And Russia is near and America is far. And although the Germans want to be on very good terms with the United States, they also, for example, in the 1990s, when the United States banks lent only a couple billion dollars to the Russians under Boris Yeltsin, the German banks, smaller than American banks, lent $20 billion. So I think we need to get coordinated with the Europeans, because the other problem we have is militarily, the United States had 400,000 troops in Europe in 1990. Today we have 85% less. We have 65,000 troops. And in some of the countries, like in Poland, we have exactly 10 fighter airplanes. Now, we're not going to war, but I think it's important that the Russians understand, not just here is what I'd like to emphasize. It's not just Ukraine. There's a lot of other places. When the Cold War ended in 1991, there were between 25 and 30 million Russians outside of Russia, because it didn't matter in those days. It was all Soviet Union. So we need to develop a coordinated policy here. And the problem is the Russians, the message they're getting is they're looking at Syria, no American intervention. They're looking at Egypt, buying weapons from the Russians. They're looking at Shinzo Abe from Japan, sitting next to Vladimir Putin. And even Viktor Orban in Hungary now is talking to the Russians. So I think we need a more active foreign policy, and it must be coordinated with our European allies, or it's just not going to be credible. Do I think they're going to invade? I don't think so. But I think what they're going to do is try the same tactics. They're already doing it. You know, get the pro-Russian forces, have them seize areas, hopefully near the border, and then send people in. It's a kind of non-invasion invasion, which worked for them in Crimea, and they're sort of trying to see if that might work again.
Top diplomats from Russia, the United States, Ukraine, and the European Union are set to hold emergency talks on the crisis Thursday in Geneva. White House officials say U.S. Vice President Joe Biden will travel to Kiev April 22nd. Amid the pro-Russian uprisings in eastern Ukraine, there is a large body of activists who support Ukrainian unity and reject Russian intervention. Their activities have remained largely underground, but they are preparing to take on their pro-Moscow opponents, as Henry Ridgewell reports from the eastern city of Donetsk.
Russia! Russia!
In the middle of a pro-Russian crowd gathered in Donetsk, Kolya, a young man barely out of his teens, is trying to go unnoticed. It is not easy. He is holding up a digital camera that's live-streaming the event to a pro-Ukrainian website so that fellow anti-Russian activists can monitor what is happening. Kolya manages to infiltrate inside the barricades. It is a dangerous game, but he emerges unscathed. Later, Kolya demonstrates the radio app on the same device that like-minded activists use to coordinate their actions.
Let's speak about how to find guys who want to be in Ukraine, defend Donetsk region from Russian occupation.
In Donetsk, Orthodox priests are putting themselves on the front line. On a central intersection, below monuments bearing old Soviet emblems, they fly the blue and yellow Ukrainian colors and hold hourly prayers for national unity. In a city elsewhere adorned with Russian insignia, it is a brave stance. Pietro Matyshenko, a priest from the Ukrainian Orthodox Church of the Kiev Patriarchy, says they are in constant danger.
То, что у нас произошло, когда мы начали молиться на площади Ленина, и нас не принимали там.
At first, we began praying in the central Lenin Square in Donetsk, but we were attacked with bats and stones, he says. Still, people are aggressive and evil, and they come here to try to destroy the tent. Inside a cafe overlooking the intersection, pro-unity activists gather to watch over the priest's tent. In hushed tones, they plot how to respond to the pro-Russian uprisings. Sergei Yeryomin is head of the Council of the Self-Proclaimed Donetsk Self-Defense Force. What could happen is a full civil war with a resistance movement, Yeryomin says. People would not stay silent to Russian intervention. They would have problems here. It would not be like in Crimea. Pro-unity demonstrators are trying to counter their pro-Russian opponents. Hundreds turned out for a rally in Donetsk Saturday, linking hands along one of the main roads in a sign of unity linking East and West, an act repeated in cities across the country.
Мы за воссоединение Украины, всей Украины, схиты разом, чтобы были все вместе. Я хочу, чтобы наша Украина...
East and West are together, says this woman. I want Ukraine to be free and independent. We Ukrainians are all brothers. In Donetsk, there are plenty who would disagree. So far, the two sides have stayed apart. Both are preparing for conflict. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, Donetsk.
What is it like to study in the United States? And what do you have to do to get here? The Student Union is VOA's blog that follows students from all over the world as they face challenges and opportunities of studying at American universities. Log on at blogs.voanews.com/student-union.
Syrian government forces launched air raids over rebel-held areas around the capital, Damascus, and districts of Aleppo, with casualties reported. Edward Uranian reports from our Middle East Bureau in Cairo.
Amateur video showed government warplanes overflying rebel-held suburbs of Damascus amid reports of bombing raids Sunday on the suburbs of Douma and Deraya. Witnesses also reported air raids and numerous casualties in and around Aleppo, the country's largest city. Government shelling against rebel-held districts of Aleppo, along with air raids Sunday, killed more than 24 people, according to Arab TV channels. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
It has been 3 years since the Arab Spring Revolt ended the 30-year rule of Egypt's president, Hosni Mubarak. It has now been 1 year since Muslim Brotherhood, backed and elected leader Mohamed Morsi, was ousted from office. Egypt is now more divided and looks to Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, the general who carried out last July's coup after protests against Morsi. Al-Sisi has since resigned from the military to run for president in May. Is history repeating itself? Kim Lewis posed this question to VOA Cairo Bureau Chief Elizabeth Arrett.
There is certainly a sense of that at 3 years after a popular uprising that got rid of a military-backed president and someone who came from the military, here we are again seeing someone from the military who has the support of the military being pretty much the presumptive next president. He will be running in the election, the former field marshal, General Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, and he doesn't really have any strong competition. There's a lot of, A, he's very popular, and B, the government has clamped down really on any opposition. So there is that sense of coming full circle.
Do you think Sisi is the one who will be able to measure up to these daunting challenges that are placed before him? Egypt has never been more divided than it is right now.
Well, certainly it doesn't appear so at the moment. And Sisi, and when we say Sisi, the government and the military behind him, he's sort of a catch-all for the powers that be. They are working very hard to break down the Muslim Brotherhood. There are thousands of members in prison. At least 1,000 have been killed since the
ouster of Islamist President Mohamed Morsi last year, and all their media has been shut down. The rest of the media is very much pro the government. They very much demonize the opposition. And it's not just the Muslim Brotherhood. Some of the original, more secular, liberal activists who brought about the revolution 3 years ago, they're now facing jail. Foreign journalists, as well as many Egyptian journalists, are in jail. It's very, very hard now to see a way out of this polarization, especially as it is largely coming from the government and its acts against anybody in the opposition, to see him turning around, at least in the immediate future, and trying to bring all these people in, especially, again, the Muslim Brotherhood is declared a terrorist organization, and it's hard to step away from those kinds of steps, and it would take quite a while, I think, before we start to see any kind of reconciliation process.
Also, do you think Egyptian officials are looking at the situation and saying that, yes, this country does need an overhaul of religious and political institutions? It's just a matter of time before we can get to that point of actually implementing this?
Well, that's a good point about time. There are so many more immediate problems. One of them is just security, because in addition to today's Friday, there are a lot of Muslim Brotherhood and other protests. It's a traditional day of protests. Those are going on. They can be very disruptive, and then they can start to get clashes for police that sort of destabilizes things. You have a true militant insurgency coming from Sinai. It was based in Sinai, but is moving closer into mainland Egypt. On top of that, you have near daily protests from students at the university campuses. You have workers' strikes. And that actually, the economic situation could be one of the most, on top of political, maybe even more of a challenge to whoever runs the next government. We're seeing electricity outages many times every day. It's very, very dire economic situation, and that could be the biggest challenge, I think, to the next government.
And you just touched on something that I was going to bring up, and that is the youth movement there, if you can call it a youth movement. The protesters are primarily students, young people. So do you think that they will likely explode again if Sisi and his future government fail to create jobs?
Well, it certainly is very much a big question. Now, a lot of these daily protests in the university tend to be more supporters of ousted President Morsi, but certainly because of the oppression also of those original Tahrir Square activists, it'll be interesting to see how as they move forward. And this is the critical difference between now and 3 years ago, that people are mobilized, they feel empowered, even with the sort of heavy-handed tactics that ban protests. We're still seeing them. People are still coming out. And this is a big bulge. It's a very youth-oriented society. And with the unemployment, I think that is, there have been vague talks about sort of making jobs, but we have not seen that translate. And that could certainly lead to further unrest.
VOA Middle East Bureau Chief Elizabeth Arad in Cairo. The UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Mali says the country is in a deepening state of humanitarian crisis, with an additional 400,000 people expected to face food insecurity by June. Humanitarian assistance is drastically underfunded, and the return of refugees who fled the conflict in 2012 and 2013 is making things worse. Jennifer Lazuta has more on the story from VOA's West Africa Bureau in Dakar.
The United Nations says that 1.4 million people in Mali are currently in need of food assistance. This is up from 812,000 people in December 2013 and could rise to 1.9 million by June as the lean season sets in. Late and erratic rains last year, combined with ongoing conflict in the north of the country, meant poor crop harvest throughout much of the country. This has meant that food stocks of many families are just not there. David Gressley is the UN Humanitarian Coordinator for Mali.
Mali continues to face very important humanitarian challenges in 2014. People have just gone through a very, very difficult period in Mali, and particularly in the north, with the conflict, with the occupation. People are even more vulnerable than normal because of all of this. We're seeing in particular on the food side continued food insecurity, and so we're quite concerned.
Gressley said an estimated 500,000 children under the age of 5 in Mali will suffer from moderate to severe malnutrition this year, and 136,000 children will be severely malnourished. He said Mali could see a spike in its child mortality rate if these cases are left untreated. He said there is also concern among humanitarian workers that the food security situation could further deteriorate as those displaced by the conflict return home.
We're seeing increasing numbers of refugees coming home. Half the IDPs have come home. Puts an additional burden on local communities as the numbers increase. It will take a while before those who are coming home can also contribute to local production. The agriculture campaign is just now starting, so they can start, but that we won't see any output from that until at the end of the year.
The United Nations Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, OCHA, says that nearly 200,000 internally displaced people, or IDPs, and refugees who fled to neighboring Niger, Mauritania, and Burkina Faso returned to the north between December and March. Gressley said there could be an acceleration of that return in coming months, particularly if progress is made with ongoing peace discussions. To help ease the burden of food insecurity in the country, Mali's government pledged to contribute 34,000 tons of cereal to food aid efforts this year. Gressley said that this is quite a significant contribution, but is not enough. OCHA reports that $568 million is needed to provide humanitarian assistance, including food aid, in Mali in 2014. As of the end of March, donors had only funded around 10%, or $56 million, of this amount. Gressley said that this lack of funding is quite worrying.
It's unfortunate, but there are many crises around the world right now in South Sudan, Central African Republic, Syria, etc., that seem to be drawing the resources that are really needed also in places like Mali. And the problem I see with that, not only the humanitarian impact, if you look at the overall needs of Mali in terms of trying to stabilize after the conflict of 2012, insufficient humanitarian assistance is actually a destabilizing impact, has a destabilizing impact as well.
Gressley said many organizations, including the World Food Program, have begun rationing their already limited resources. They hope to buy some time until more funding comes in. He said the UN is now trying to raise additional money by advising donors that there is still a significant and pressing need for humanitarian assistance in Mali. Jennifer Lazuda for VOA News, Dakar.
Hi, I'm David Byrne.
And I'm Lin Yang.
I'm Aisha Holly.
And I'm Madeline Eck.
We're the hosts of VOA's Now.
We'll be bringing you stories that interest you.
Join the conversation
every Monday, Tuesday, and Wednesday,
beginning April 28th for the Voice of America's Now.
Christians have celebrated Palm Sunday, the start of the Holy Week. Robert Berger attended festivities in Jerusalem.
Bells called the faithful to Palm Sunday prayers at the Church of the Holy Sepulchre in Jerusalem's Old City, the traditional site of Jesus' crucifixion and resurrection. Palm Sunday marks the beginning of Easter Holy Week and Jesus' entry into Jerusalem on a donkey more than 2,000 years ago. Inside the church, worshipers waving palm and olive branches held a festive Palm Sunday procession around the ancient stone tomb revered by believers as the place where Jesus rose from the dead. They marched through a fragrant cloud of incense, chanting Hosanna, blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord. Pilgrims came from around the world, including Miriam Akin of Nigeria.
Oh, I feel great. I feel awesome. I feel elated. And I give all the glory to God for bringing us to this awesome place.
Jane Reynolds of the U.S. state of Georgia said Palm Sunday in Jerusalem brings the Bible to life.
This is where Jesus actually went down that hill into the city. It just is amazing to me to think I'm in the same spot. And to think that it really happened and that it's not just black and white on the pages.
Jerusalem will host a flood of pilgrims this week as Easter week coincides with the Jewish feast of Passover, which begins at sundown on Monday. Robert Berger for VOA News in Jerusalem's Old City.
American golfer Bubba Watson has won the Masters for the second time in 3 years. Watson claimed the prestigious green jacket that goes to the champion of golf's first major tournament each year by shooting a final round 3 under par 69 Sunday. That gave him a four-round total of 8 under par 280 and a three-stroke victory over countryman Jordan Spieth and Sweden's Jonas Blixt. At 20 years old, Spieth was bidding to become the youngest ever champion at the Augusta National Club in the southeast U.S. state of Georgia. Thank you for joining us today for International Edition. You can get the latest breaking news and analysis on global events 24 hours a day on our website at voanews.com. I'm Susan Yawkey in Washington.
This is Today in History. On April 14th in the year 70 AD, Roman forces under the future Emperor Titus surrounded the Jewish capital, Jerusalem. Titus later sacked the city, killing many of its residents and scattering Jewish survivors among the nations. On this day in 1759, German composer George Frederick Handel died. Handel, who spent most of his adult life in London, is most famous for his oratorio, Messiah. In 1775, inspired by Quaker activists, the first American anti-slavery organization was formed in Philadelphia. In 1828, Noah Webster copyrighted the first edition of his famous dictionary. It took him 26 years to complete. In 1865, while attending a performance of the comedy Our American Cousin, President Abraham Lincoln was shot at Ford's Theater in Washington. He died the next day. It was the first presidential assassination in U.S. history. In 1906, the Azusa Street Revival opened in Los Angeles, launching the worldwide religious movement known as Pentecostalism. In 1927, the first Volvo car premiered in Gothenburg, Sweden. In 1935, this was Black Sunday, as one of the strongest in a series of dust storms swept across parts of New Mexico, Texas, Colorado, Oklahoma, and Kansas. The dirt and dust built up by drought and soil erosion was driven by high prairie winds. On this day in 2002, the late Venezuelan President Hugo Chavez returned to office after initially being ousted in an unsuccessful military coup. I'm Dave DeForest with VOA's Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Leaders from four Southeast Asian nations have agreed to strengthen regional cooperation in developing and protecting the water resources on the Mekong River Basin. Meeting in Ho Chi Minh City April 2nd through 5th, the premiers of Vietnam, Laos, Cambodia, and the special envoy of Thailand approved a declaration recommitting their nations to the 1995 Mekong Agreement that created a framework to build consensus among Mekong Basin nations on development and other issues. The lower Mekong River runs from China through the four Southeast Asian nations to the sea. Nearly 70 million people in the basin rely heavily on the river for their livelihoods, and those involved in irrigated agriculture and fishing make up 85% of the workforce there. Because problems at any point could affect millions of people downstream, nations along the river organized in 1994 to form the Mekong River Commission to work cooperatively to address them. At the commission's second summit in Ho Chi Minh City last week, leaders identified ensuring water, energy, and food security in the context of climate change as priorities they will focus on in the months to come. The United States congratulates the Commission and its member nations for nearly two decades of achievement. Through the MRC, regional governments have improved the lives of millions of people through sustainable economic development and regional cooperation. That said, the challenges facing the Commission and the River Basin nations are greater than ever before. Increasing demands on the Mekong's resources, rapid development, and the effects of climate change are putting greater pressure on the river, threatening a unique environment and the livelihoods of millions. Responding to these challenges will require greater scientific and technical capacity, increased investment, and still more regional cooperation. Through programs such as the Lower Mekong Initiative and Connect Mekong, The United States is committed to supporting the efforts of the Mekong River Basin nations to improve regional cooperation and management of the river's resources, providing a sustainable future for all who depend on the waters of the Mekong.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.